Mouse Audio Podcast Network.
What's up, Fam-a-Lam? It's another episode of Whining About History, the women's history podcast for two longtime friends. Drink wine and chat about women from history you probably hadn't heard of. I'm Emily.
I can't believe you said Fam-a-Lam.
We were testing our audio before and I screamed into the mic, "What's up, Fam-a-Lam?" And Kelly's just like, no. Could not be in the same room with me. And so the second she told me it was my intro, I'm like, this is my moment. This is what everything of my life has been leading up to.
And I'm Kelly, by the way. She said I'm Emily, and then I just went, why?
Yeah, you're not Kelly anymore. You're disgusted.
I'm shamed.
Sincerely shameful co-host. Shamed co-host.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, let's just jump right on into it. Before we get to the wine, we have a very special Say Their Name.
Yes, a very special Say Their Name.
So special and sweet that I'm getting a cavity thinking about
right,
it.
Right, I know. So I'm going to sad cry. Or not sad cry, happy cry?
Manic.
Manic cry, yeah.
Overwhelming emotion cry.
Overwhelming emotion cry. So this one goes out to Veronica Anaya from her son, Michael, and he said, quote, that I love her and thank you for being you, for being the most wonderful, loving, caring, supportive mother anyone could have asked for, and also being a strong, badass single mother and for never, ever wavering when times got tough, end quote.
Veronica.
You sound amazing and we love you.
You raised a good kid.
Yeah.
What a sweetie. So Veronica's actually apparently just discovered our podcast
and
cried so hard that her mascara ran.
And she was jealous of our wine.
That's one hell of a compliment. If you can make a lady cry where it ruins her makeup, you have done your job.
And it was laugh crying, yeah. Not like, oh my God, everything is terrible crying.
I mean, God, hopefully. Some of these episodes are pretty heavy.
That is true.
But Veronica, welcome to the Fam-a-Lam. This is my new thing. No, you're a history hero and we love you.
We do.
And actually, that's a good segue into how Veronica and Michael found us. We did a thing, you guys.
We did do a thing.
It was an amazing thing. So we were recently on the Earfloss Music History Podcast, where we got to team up with the host Kenny to cover Billie fucking Holiday. And she is not a woman we probably would have covered on this podcast. She's
probably
a little,
not. Maybe,
she's a little
but
more well
maybe
known,
not. Yeah.
You know, than we usually cover. And so getting to know her story was incredible.
When
she had
getting to
such
know her
light.
Music,
yes.
It was a good rabbit hole for once.
Oh my God. There's so much on her too.
Yeah.
And so please, you can find Earfloss wherever you find Whining About Herstory. It's episode 14, Billie Holiday. Go give it a listen. We are charming as hell.
Yes. Yes, and we are. Kenny's pretty good, too.
Kenny is fantastic. I love him. We're
besties. He's going. Yeah, he's going to come on at some point when we figure all out logistics.
Yeah, so stay tuned. But for anyone who found us through the Earfloss podcast, welcome to our family of herstory heroes.
You say that again.
Her whole body just clenched. Like I could feel her butt just tightening up.
Oh, that's funny. But yes, welcome. And we hope you enjoy. But a special shout out to Veronica.
Veronica,
for joining us.
You're a fucking goddess. And
yes,
we love you.
We do.
You're our best friend now.
Yeah.
Get ready for that.
Be prepared.
Be prepared because we go overboard on the love.
Yeah, we do.
It's inappropriate.
It's a little bit too much.
It's, yeah.
But we deal with it. And so you have to deal with it. And now, on to the wine.
All right. So so Kelly and I, this is the first time we've bought wine together.
Yeah.
Just before recording, we made a serious wine run.
43 episodes in, we finally actually went on a wine run.
No, this is 44.
Together. No, this is 43.
No, it's 44.
It's 43.
I must have misnumbered some episodes.
Oh, well, then I was supposed to go first.
I don't know what's going on. Anyway.
It is 44. I was supposed to go first.
Okay, well, whatever.
Damn it. I could have picked a wine to go with my woman.
Well, damn it. I got to say Fam-a-Lam, so suck it. But so Kelly and I made a massive wine run, and we bought 6 bottles of wine total. So we are set for a month and a half of
good
episodes. And so Kelly actually found this bottle for me. It's Saint John Commandaria, and it looks like a pie. It looks like a whiskey bottle almost, because it's got the fat bottom.
Yeah.
It's like a short fat bottom and then the long neck, and it's very epic. And it's a red sweet wine from the island of Cyprus, produced and bottled by Keo PLC. I don't have to read that shit. Sorry. And the back of the label says, a delicious sweet wine of nobility, Commandaria has the oldest tradition of any individually named wine in the whole world. Ooh. Damn! Yeah. I'm definitely not fancy enough to drink this. Excellent accompaniment with fruit after dinner, served straight up or with fruit.
Oh, we're doing the straight up. It says with We're doing the straight up version.
Yeah, this says with fruit twice.
It's just, it's hammering home the fruit. Just really wants you to drink it with fruit.
Yeah, and this is 15% Ooh. ABV, so it's a little heavier. I am terrified to drink this because as I'm like waiting for Kelly to buy her wine, I'm standing with my bag. The manager of the liquor store comes up and he goes, did you buy my last bottle of Greek church wine? And I'm like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because I need to know how to respond here.
Right? Like, do I say yes or do I, like, shove my bag to the side and be like, no?
I don't know what you're talking about. Someone clearly shoved it down their pants. And I don't know. But I was like, yes. And he didn't really...
He just kind of walked away.
Yeah. So I'm like, he's got me pegged. I'm not good enough to drink this wine. But God damn it, we're doing it.
It's also like... It kind of looks like root beer in the glass. Like, it's
amber color.
I assume it's supposed to be a red.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just like the spices or the aging or what, but it's like a brown.
And the whole room smells like wine right now. This shit is powerful. And I may have poured my glass too full. Like, I may have overcommitted to this one.
When you look at the photo, Emily's is the really full one.
Yes.
Mine is the one that I'm like, pour like half of the amount of yours.
Yeah. All right, so what are we cheersing to?
Veronica.
Hell yeah. By the way, Veronica, we love your name because Kelly and I regularly watch Veronica Mars before this.
Yeah.
So
Veronica is just a badass name.
It is. All right. Cheers, Veronica.
Cheers, Veronica.
That was a good clink. I'm scared.
So usually we end up drinking some of the wine before we end up podcasting.
Yeah.
We haven't tasted this one yet. So this will be our 100% true reaction to this.
Okay. Should we count down? One, two, three. Holy fuck. Oh my. Oh, it changes. It changes in your mouth.
It tastes like a raisin.
It does.
Like, that's not a bad thing. Like, I actually don't mind raisins. I'd rather have a raisin than a craisin. I just wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
But it tastes like a raisin.
At first, it was kind of sweet like candy, and then the flavor, like, evolves in your mouth. It's a
raisin.
Well, they have a lot of dates on Cyprus, don't they? Like,
I've never been a date-heavy
island. I don't know.
I don't know. It's just so weird, because it smells almost like brown sugar or, like, molasses. Yeah. So when I was, like, taking my sip, that's what all I could smell, but then it tastes like a raisin.
Yeah, that is...
I'm not sure how I feel about this.
We have definitely never drinking wine like this. This is a first. I 100% bet this is, like, made out of raisins or dates or whatever dates are before they become dates.
I think dates are always dates.
But then they just get shriveled and they become shriveled dates?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think a date's just a thing. Now I'm Googling.
Mother Google, what is a date? I've never had one.
I think I've tried one. Yeah, it's a date palm. Like, it's a palm tree that grows dates. Yeah, dates
are
just a thing.
Yeah, I bet it is. It's like a raisin or a date taste. So if you're into that and you want it in alcoholic liquid form, this is the wine for you.
Yeah. So even though I made you pick the wine, I'm going to go first so we don't fuck up our episode order.
That is totally fine with me.
Because it isn't even, and that means I go first.
Okay. I don't think anyone actually gives a shit.
I do. No, I don't. But I'm just going to go first.
Please do.
Because mine's long. So yes. We're going to get the long one out of the way first. That way, if people start falling asleep, it's during your part, not mine.
Okay. Well.
I'm kidding.
Love you
I'm
too, kidding. Bitch.
All right. So born Mary Phelps Jacob on 1821. I'm starting off great.
What? So, she was born in 2 years.
April 20th, 1891.
I thought you said 1812, 1891.
I did. Just cut all that out.
Oh my God, no.
Mary Phelps Jacob was born April 20th, 1891 in New Rochelle, New York. She was the oldest daughter of Mary Phelps and William Hearn Jacob. She had two brothers, Leonard and Walter, and she was nicknamed Polly to distinguish her from her mother because they were both named Mary Phelps.
Okay, then don't name your kid fucking Mary. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm a strong advocate for whatever you plan on calling your kid.
Name them that.
Yeah, like, if you're not going to call them Elizabeth and you really want to call them Beth for the rest of their lives, name them Beth. It's a fine name.
Right. So I'm just going to refer to her as Polly for the rest of this.
Okay, so Polly.
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 Just Polly. Just for now.
No last name. Well, I forgot her last name. Polly Jacob. Phelps
Polly
Jacobs.
Yeah, Polly Phelps Jacob.
Okay,
but we're just going to go with Polly.
She's a PP&J.
All right. So her family wasn't, like, super rich, but her father was raised, as she put it, so this was her quote, to ride to hounds, sailboats, and lead cotillions, end quote.
So he can do it all.
He lived the high life.
Okay.
In 1914, she was presented to the King of England at a garden party, and in keeping with the American aristocratic style of the time, she was even photographed as a child by Charles Dana Gibson.
And she wasn't even dead.
Right.
That post-mortem photography is
so creepy.
Chilling.
So she grew up in what she later said, quote, in a world where only good smells existed.
So she's having a really stellar childhood.
Yep. She said, what I wanted usually came to pass. Again, that was her direct quote. She was rather uninterested in school, so she, like, didn't care about school, and author Jeffrey Wolfe wrote about her later that she lived her life in dreams.
Can I go to her childhood and just never leave, because it sounds way better than my reality, and she's a woman
weird.
In the 1800s.
I was telling Emily that I'm like, okay, so like I covered what I wanted to cover and then the story just gets weird. So just strap on. Yeah. So her family divided its time between their two different estates, one in Connecticut, one in New York, and she enjoyed the advantages of an upper-class lifestyle. She attended formal balls, Ivy League school dances, formal horse riding lessons.
Jesus!
Yeah. She took dancing lessons from Mr. Dodsworth Dancing Class, which I'm assuming is some famous thing that I've never heard of. She attended Miss Chapin's school in New York City and then boarded at Rosemary Hall, a prep school in Connecticut.
Do you ever, like, get in your research and they say a name as if it's supposed to mean something?
Right,
and you're like,
I don't know, I just assume
that's a big deal.
Right. Her father died in 1908, and after that she went to live with her mother at their home in Connecticut. That same summer she would meet her future husband, Richard Peabody, at summer camp. He comes into play later,
What a
obviously.
Place to meet your future hubby.
Right. At this time she was approaching her debut. We don't have those anymore.
That's when, like...
It's when rich people are like, here's my daughter, you should marry her. Or fuck her, you know. Whatever.
I mean, one leads to the other in this society.
Right. So, approaching her own debut, she danced in, quote, 1 to 3 balls every night and slept from 4 in the morning until noon. At 12, I was called and got ready for the customary debutante luncheon, end quote.
I love the fancy voice you're putting on. The debutante luncheon.
She graduated from Rosemary Hall Prep in 1910 at age 19. So she's 19 now.
Okay.
Which must have been when they came out back then. If you watch like Gossip Girl, it's like 16 now. Or maybe it's 18. But at this time, apparently, it was 19.
I was going to say, I feel like 16 or 18 are kind of
the big numbers. Because 21 seems too late.
Yeah, no, you're shriveled up like a date in the sun.
So in 1910, again at age 19, Polly was preparing to attend yet another debutante ball. As was customary, she put on a corset stiffened with whalebone and a restrictive tight corset cover that flattened and jammed her large breasts together into a single mono bosom.
I think I know who you're covering,
so,
and I'm so
I just love
excited.
So we uncultured swine today call it a mono boob, and I just love back then that they called it a mono bosom.
It sounds a little classier.
It just makes me laugh.
Yeah,
just, every time I kept it in my notes mainly for that reason. Like
this
mono bosom.
Sports bra gives me a supportive mono bosom.
Right.
I feel very tight and in control of my bosom.
Yeah, a corset that was cinched in to form as tiny waist as possible, and the woman's torso was held very erect, if you don't know how corsets work. A corset was very confining, and it would have been difficult to feel comfortable, And, you know, it's not really easy to, like, dance, especially, like, today.
Imagine having a bunch of it's whale bones tightly strapped to your abdomen to the point where
and you can't bend over.
And it's moving your organs around inside you.
Yeah, it's not fun.
It's like having an insane back brace.
So Mary wore an... See, like, they interchange her name in my notes, and apparently I didn't change it.
Polly Pocket.
Wore a dress that she had worn previously to her debut a few weeks previous, like I said. It was a sheer evening gown with a plunging neckline that displayed her ample cleavage.
Her mono bosom.
Yep. The corset, however, or the corset cover, was a box-like armor of whalebone and pink cordage poked out from under her gown. At this time, she called Marie, her personal maid, and told her, quote, "Bring me two of my pocket handkerchiefs and some pink ribbon, and bring the needle and thread and some pins." She fashioned the handkerchiefs and ribbons into a simple bra. And
brassiere.
Yeah, brassiere.
As they probably called it.
Mary's new undergarment complemented the new fashions of the time, and she was mobbed after the dance by other girls who wanted to know how she moved so freely. And when she showed her new garment to her friends the next day, they all wanted one. One day, she received a request for one of her contraptions from a stranger who offered $1 for her efforts, and she knew then that this could be a viable business.
Oh my god, this is fantastic.
Polly filed for a patent for her invention on February 12th, 1914, so like 4 years later.
Was she making them between then?
I have no, it didn't say.
She opened her Etsy shop and she's just selling bras.
And in November of that year, the United States Patent and Trademark Office granted her patent for the backless brassiere.
Mm.
Polly likened her design to corset covers, which covered the bosom when a woman wore a low corset. Her design had shoulder straps, which attached to the garment's upper and lower corners, and wraparound laces attached at the lower corners, which tied the woman's front, enabling her to wear gowns cut low in the back.
Showing off those bosoms!
Right. Polly wrote that her invention was, quote, "well adapted to women of different sizes and so efficient that it may be worn by persons engaged in violent exercise, like tennis," end quote.
Oh my god. A bra for every occasion.
Right. Her design was lightweight, soft, and comfortable to wear, and naturally separated the breasts, unlike a corset, which was heavy, stiff, uncomfortable, and had the effect of creating a mono bosom.
So now you're dual wielding your bosoms.
Right, exactly.
Each one more powerful than the other somehow.
Well, Polly's design was the first granted a patent within its category. So she was like the first woman to come up with what I read is the more modern day brassiere, basically.
Yeah.
Because other people, both in the U.S. Patent Office and the foreign patent offices, had issued other patents for bra-like undergarments by this time.
But they all sucked.
As early as the 1860s, actually.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Like, she's not the first to, like, design a bra, but she's the first to really design and patent, like, a modern style bra.
Yeah. One that didn't suck as much.
Right. As much.
Well, it sounds like the others weren't, because I'm trying to think of I'm grabbing my boobs.
I know.
I'm imagining my bra right now, and I'm trying to imagine, like, modern day bras are not perfect. Don't get me wrong. Mine can be a pain in the ass, but I'm trying to imagine, like, any other way to do it,
really?
Well,
see, that's why I think a lot of times it was corsets.
Yeah, but, like, I'm trying to imagine, like, the pre-bras, the predecessors to bras that weren't
Apparently
corsets.
Apparently it was two handkerchiefs and some cordage.
Well, that was the good one.
Yeah.
That was the good one. That was the one that, you know, lasted.
That's funny.
Like, what were they doing otherwise?
So during all of this, in 1915, Polly married Richard Dick Peabody. They were married by his grandfather, whose family had been one of the wealthiest in America during the 19th century. And by the 20th century, the Peabodys had supplanted the Cabots and the Lodges as the most distinguished name in the region.
Okay, I'm sorry. The guy's name is Dick Peabody, and
yep,
he's the most distinguished name? What the fuck?
Well, his family, not just him.
Well, him specifically, because Peabody, okay, that's kind of a funny name, but Dick Peabody?
Richard.
That's worse, because his name was Dick his nickname or his middle
Dick
name?
Yeah, Dick his nickname.
Okay, so Dick Peabody, his parents clearly hated him. They're like, we're going to try again. This one's our mulligan.
Oh,
let's name him Dick. Dick Peabody.
Polly found Dick's temperament to be far from her own. When they had a son, William Jacob, in 1916, she found, quote, "Dick was not the most indulgent of parents, and like his father before him, he forbade the gurgles and cries of infancy. When they occurred, he walked out and often walked back unsteady," end quote.
Oh, so he was a drinker. He's like, I can't deal with this right now.
I'm gonna go have a drink, yeah.
I mean, same, but right. Dude, that's why I'm not having kids.
Polly concluded that Dick was well-educated, but an undirected man and a reluctant father. Less than a year later, he enlisted at the Mexican border and joined the Boston militia engaged in stopping Pancho Villa's cross-border raids. Less than a year after that, after he returned home, he enlisted in fighting in World War I. Their second child, a daughter, Pauline Wheatland, aka Polly. Why do they keep doing this?
Oh my god. At least that one is close. Polly is not even anywhere close to Mary.
No, but the mom's called Polly, and now they named their daughter Pauline and also call her Polly.
See, it's almost the opposite because it was Mary, Mary. Right. Well, we can't call the daughter Mary because the mom's name's already Mary, so we're going to call her something different. This time, it's like, well, my name's not actually Mary, but I'm called Polly, but I'm going to name my kid something close.
Yeah, right. And then call her the same name. Anyways, so their daughter, Pauline, was born in 1917, but Dick was already away at officers' training camp in New York. He became a commissioned second lieutenant in artillery and then became captain of the United States Army's 15th Field Artillery. Polly was largely left alone and cared for by his parents at this time. She found, quote, "My father-in-law was a stickler for polish both in manners and minerals, while her mother-in-law wore nun-like dresses in bed or out with starched cuffs as severe as piping," end quote.
You know what they sound like? You know Corpse Bride, the movie? Yep. You know Veronica? Is it Veronica? Is that the girl? Not
I
the
think
Corpse
so.
Bride.
No, the girl. I think it's Veronica.
Yeah. I'm picturing her parents,
right?
Because you know they are repressed as fuck. Also, can we acknowledge that Polly's husband joined the military to run away from being a dad?
My last quote about him being in the military was, she talks about how, you know, her in-laws are
repressed and sticky and gross.
Yeah. Her husband, meanwhile, was enjoying life at the front as a bachelor. So he was sleeping around. At war.
Wow. He would prefer to be at war,
right,
fucking everyone, than being a dad. Some people shouldn't have kids.
Yeah. So during this time, Polly filed a legal certificate with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in 1920, declaring that while she was a married woman, she was conducting business using a separate funds from her husband's bank account. Apparently you were allowed to do that, which is nice.
Okay.
She founded the Fashion Form Brasier Company and located her manufacturing shop on Washington Street in Boston, where she opened a two-woman sweatshop that manufactured her wireless brasier in 1922.
A sweatshop?
Yep, that's how they described it.
Oh, no!
Apparently, sweatshop literally just stands for anywhere that's, like, just has shitty working conditions.
Yeah!
So, in her autobiography called The Passionate Years, she maintained that she had, quote, "a few hundred units of her design produced." She managed to secure a few orders from department stores, but her business never took off.
That sucks.
I know.
Man, because all the women at that party were like, I need this because right. I don't want to feel like I'm going to die.
Much later, she ended up selling her brassiere patent to the Warner Brothers Corset Company for $1,500. Yeah, I don't ask questions.
I'm making a face.
She's like, Warner Brothers?
Like Looney Tunes Warner Brothers?
Apparently. So she sold it for $1,500, which is about $23,000 today, which is not much.
That's nothing.
Warner continued manufacturing the Crosby bra for a while because she soon gets remarried, this is later.
Okay.
So they continue manufacturing her bra, but it was not a popular style and was eventually discontinued. In later years, she wrote, quote, "I can't say the brassiere will ever take as great a place in history as the steamboat, but I did invent it," end quote.
I love that. It's like, hey, I'm not saying it's a steamboat.
So
but
that was like the reason I wanted to look her up was the invention of the brassiere. And now it just gets weird.
Okay. So she invented the bra and now shit takes off.
Yeah.
Because it already hasn't been weird.
Yeah. So she kind of starts changing about now. The catalyst for her change was her introductional and eventual marriage to Harry Crosby. He's a wealthy scion of a socially prominent Boston family and another veteran and victim of the recent war. He had attended private schools up until he was 19, and he was well on the way to being a comfortable upper middle class guy until he went to World War One.
Oh no!
So he volunteered as the American Field Service Ambulance Corps, along with Ernest Hemingway. Apparently,
oh,
that was like a sub note in my notes.
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, Ernest Hemingway. So on November 22nd, 1917, the ambulance he was driving was destroyed by artillery fire. But he miraculously emerged unhurt. His best friend, Spud Spaulding, was seriously wounded in the explosion, but Harry saved his life. The experience profoundly shaped Harry's future. He stayed in and went on to the Second Battle of Verdun, and after the battle, his section was cited for bravery, and in 1919, he was one of the youngest Americans awarded the Croix de Guerre, which is a medal for bravery.
Wow. So this is what happens when you go to war not to run away from your family.
Right, exactly. Crosby wrote in his journal, quote, "Most people die of a sort of creeping common sense and discover when it's too late that the only thing one never regrets are one's mistakes," end quote. From this point on, he vowed he would live life on his own terms.
All right. So he's like, hey, I've seen death. It's brushed past me.
Right.
Fuck everything. I'm just going to go for it. That's actually, I wonder if he has just a smidgeny bit of PTSD, because that can be a symptom, that like impulsiveness or that like not thinking into the future, because you know the future
may not exist.
It's not even just the way that we all think about, like we know the future is not guaranteed, but it's that having faced the idea of the future not being there anymore.
So after returning home from World War One, he met Polly at an Independence Day picnic. Polly's husband, Dick, was in the sanatorium drying out from another drunken spell.
Oh, Dick.
And sensing Polly's isolation, Harry's mother, Henrietta... God damn it. God damn it, history!
Henrietta.
Spud's falling and Harry and Henrietta.
Oh, my
Jesus.
God.
So Henrietta invited Polly to be a chaperone for Harry and some friends, you know, mixed company, because back then you needed a chaperone.
Yeah, you couldn't.
She was older and married.
Yeah. Although Henrietta sounds like she knows what she's doing. She's like, I'm not saying you guys need to fall in love and get married. I'm just putting you guys in the same airspace.
Well, yeah, but he was with another girl at the time. Like, it was a date. It was like a double, triple date of a situation. But they needed a chaperone.
Okay.
So they asked Polly to chaperone and go to a dinner and a trip to the amusement park with, like, Harry and his friends.
God, that sounds
so
fun.
So she was 28 at the time, married with two small children.
Jesus Christ, that's how old I am, and all of that sounds like way too much.
Harry was 22, slight of build, with an unusual blonde hairstyle, a pale complexion, a weak constitution,
and a consuming
gaze and enormous charisma. Charisma is totally what they mean.
Yeah, it was his
enormous charisma.
Yeah.
During dinner, Harry never spoke to the girl on his left, breaking decorum, because that's the girl he was, you know, supposed to be with.
Yeah, you're supposed to be polite and, like, acknowledge that she took time out of her day to be here.
By some accounts, Harry fell in love with the buxom Mrs. Peabody in about 2 hours.
And her dual boobs.
Right. He confessed his love for her in the tunnel of love at the amusement park.
Jesus!
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was,
same day, on a date with a different girl.
Right. Crosby pressed her to see him alone, an unthinkable proposition for a member of Boston's upper crust. She later wrote, quote, "Harry was utterly ruthless. To know Harry was a devastating experience."
Oh, my
quote.
God.
I stopped because Emily, like, gave me a look. She was
this
like,
is so
what?
Sexy.
On July 20th, they spent the night together and had sex.
Hell yeah!
And 2 days,
get it, Polly.
2 days later, Polly accompanied Harry to New York. He had planned a trip to France to tour battle sites, and they spent the night together in New York at the Belmont Hotel. Polly said of the night, quote, "For the first time in my life, I knew myself to be a person," end quote.
Damn. That sounds like a romance novel. Like, that's hot.
Polly was seen in her social circle as someone who had perverted the trust placed in her as a chaperone, as an older woman who had taken advantage of a younger man.
Hey.
To the Crosbys, she was dishonored and corrupt. Polly and Harry's scandalous courtship was the gossip of Blue Blood Boston.
Try saying that three times fast while drunk.
In the fall, Dick moved back home. His parents supplied them a small living allowance. And Dick, Polly, and the two children moved into a tenement building.
Oh.
A three-story tenement building.
Like, did they own it?
I think his parents did, and they lived there.
It sounds like they're living the high life, and then they're moving into a tenement.
They're still living the high life. Like, okay. I think it was owned by his parents.
So they're living nicely. It's not when we usually talk about tenement buildings.
Yeah, like, it's probably not as nice as they were used to.
But it wasn't squalor.
Yeah.
Okay.
At this time, Crosby was, or at this, Henry. Harry? What is his name? Harry.
Henry. Oh, is it Harry?
Yeah, I think I've said Henry several times, but it's Harry.
Well, because it's Henrietta is his mother, or Harriet?
Henrietta.
Okay. So Henrietta and Harry.
Harry was living with his father, and Dick decided to go to Harvard. So we got all these different people in different places.
Oh, my God.
While Dick was working at the bank and studying, Harry sent crates of flowers from his mother's garden to Polly's apartment and brought over toys for the children. They would drive to the shore together.
I'll never replace your dad, right. But I won't be drunk all the time and go off to war to avoid you.
Dick volunteered to join the fire department and persuaded the fire chief to wire an alarm bell into his home so he could turn out at any hour. He liked to watch things burn, apparently.
Oh my God, that's
he
horrifying.
Probably also had PTSD.
Yeah.
The fire chief soon let Dick go, and Dick retreated into drinking again. At this time, Henry was still pursuing Polly, and in May 1921, she stopped responding to his ardor. I just liked that word, so I left it in
What's
there.
Ardor? Like?
Like devotion.
Oh, his attention.
Yeah.
Okay.
At that time, he threatened suicide if Polly would not marry him.
Oh, yep. No.
That's Harry. When you run. That's when you run in the opposite direction. Women.
I think this is a great opportunity for a quick little PSA. Thank you. If you have a partner who threatens to kill themselves.
Run as far as you can in the opposite
first
direction.
First of all. You are not obligated to stay because that is an abusive manipulation tactic. And if anything happens to them, it is not your fault. What you do is you get the fuck out of there and you can call 911. Like,
right. Or call his parents if you know them. Like,
yeah. But you
if
do
you feel you need to call someone, which you don't.
But you're not like that's a common abusive manipulation tactic. And you are not. Yeah. You need to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
This is not romantic and you don't have to save anyone.
So he threatens that.
Gross.
And during this time, Dick was in and out of sanitariums fighting alcoholism.
Yeah.
So she's dealing with, like, shit on both sides.
Oh my God. Can Polly just find, like, a stable human being?
No. No, she can't.
Not allowed.
So eventually, he pestered Polly enough to tell... He kept pestering Polly to tell her husband of their affair and to divorce him. In May, she finally revealed her adultery to Dick and suggested a separation, and he offered no resistance, obviously.
He doesn't give a shit. He's just existing and happens to be married with children.
Polly's mother insisted that she stop seeing Harry. I have to, like, think about his name.
I keep thinking Harry Dick. Yeah, that's how I remember. That's funny. Harry Dick.
So she insisted she stop seeing Harry for 6 months to avoid complete rejection from her society peers. And that was a condition she agreed to. And she left Boston and went to New York for 6 months. Because at this time, divorce was unheard of, even among Boston Episcopalians.
I
like that they just, like, call out that one group of people.
I also like how the Boston elite, the Boston blue bloods, the Boston Episcopalians, like the Boston pie. Can we just have Boston cream pie?
Yeah.
That sounds delicious.
So Dick's parents, Peabody's parents, were outraged that she asked for a divorce and at her affair with Harry. His father, Jacob, visited Harry's father, Stephen Crosby, in 1922 to discuss the situation.
This is so high school. The parents are getting involved. Like, do I need to talk to Harry's parents?
But Harry's father would not talk to him. Despite his disapproval of what Harry had done, he loved his son.
Also, he's a fucking adult.
Right? Stephen Crosby also attempted to dissuade Harry from marrying Polly. So his dad tried to persuade him from marrying Polly and even bought him a Stutz, which is a type of car that he'd been asking for. But Harry would not be persuaded to change his mind.
This is Gossip Girl.
Right?
This is like rich people problems with the parents getting involved.
For her part, Polly's former friends pilloried her as an adulteress, leaving Polly stunned by the quick turnaround in their attitude towards her. Polly later described Harry's character as, quote, "He seemed to be more expressive in mood than man, yet he was the most vivid personality I've ever known, electric with rebellion." While they separated in 1921, her and Dick... So, June 1921 is when they separated.
Okay.
He offered to divorce her in December, and by February 1922, they were finally actually legally divorced.
Okay.
Side note, Dick subsequently recovered from his alcoholism and published a book called The Common Sense of Drinking, and he was the first person to assert that there was no cure for alcoholism. And his book became a bestseller and was a major influence onto the Alcoholics Anonymous founder. So,
okay.
Sub note, dude did really well after they got divorced.
Like, was he just so depressed at the fact that he was married with children, he just Probably. Drank and drank and drank?
Right.
Okay, but here's my other thing. You said he quit drinking and then asserted there's no cure for alcoholism.
Yeah.
But he quit drinking. I mean, I guess it's not a cure. That's
yeah,
just
exactly.
You're not feeding the illness?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay.
So things didn't get much better with Henry because Henry was working at a bank, and then he decided to go on a 6-day drinking spree and resign from his job.
What is with, like, I'm not trying to blame Polly, but all Jesus, the men around her are like, I'm gonna drink.
Right. So in May of 1922, he moved to Paris to work in a job arranged for him by his parents at a different bank. Polly had previously traveled to England to visit her cousins. And so they met up in England, and they met up in Paris, and they lived together from May to July in Paris. In July, Polly returned to the U.S., and in September, Harry proposed to her via transatlantic cable.
Oh, those are the most romantic dots and dashes I've ever heard. She's like hearing the dots, and she's, oh my God, Harry. Oh,
it was
my
a marriage
God.
Proposal, Emily.
That was old school sexting. Right. Just, oh, you dirty boy. Yeah, that's where I like it. Just hold down.
So he proposed to her via transatlantic cable, and then the next day bribed his way onto the RMS
Titanic. No, please no.
Aquitania, Ooh. Bound for New York. So he bribed his way on board, got to New York. Polly met him at the customs barrier, and they were married in the municipal building in New York City that afternoon.
I'm kind of surprised that she married him because it seemed like she was...
I know.
Like, you're hot and I'm really digging all this, but I don't know about you.
Right.
Like,
so 2 days after they got married, they reboarded the Aquitania and moved with her children this time to Paris, where Harry continued to work at the bank.
Okay.
After arriving in Paris, Polly's bubble was burst when she learned shortly after that Harry had been flirting with a girl from Boston. It was the first of many flirtatious and affairs that Polly would learn to live with.
God damn
it, Harry.
I
told you, it got weird.
Harry, you son of a bitch!
In early 1923, Polly introduced Harry to her friend Constance Coolidge. Constance, who didn't care what others thought about her and loved being risky and was addicted to gambling, soon began a sexual relationship with Harry.
Honestly, she sounds like the chick version of Harry.
Right. In 1923, Polly could no longer put up with the affair and left for London. They kind of just stopped mentioning her kids at this point.
I was going to say, they seem like just people who exist in the world.
I assume they were probably just going with her, but I don't know. Harry told Constance that he could not meet Polly's demand that he, quote, love her more than anyone else in this world. This was absolutely impossible. But Crosby would not leave Polly, nor did Constance ask him to. But when Constance received a letter from Polly who confessed that the affair was making her very miserable, Constance wrote Harry and told him she would not see him anymore.
Oh!
Harry was devastated by her decision. Quote, your letter was bar none the worst blow I've ever received. I wouldn't leave her under any circumstance, nor, as you say, would you ever marry me. End quote. However, the three did remain friends.
Okay. Kind of good on Constance because she's like, hey, I'm totally cool with this, but your wife isn't. So
I'm going to leave.
It's almost like a... I don't want to say it's like an open relationship because Polly was clearly never consulted or gave consent to it. But it sounds like Constance's participation was solely on the basis that she wasn't wrecking people's
lives. Right, exactly.
It's like, Harry, your dick is good. It's not that good, all right? I'm not going to like hurt another woman for you.
Right, okay. So they're living a glamorous and luxurious lifestyle, and it soon began to include an open marriage, numerous affairs, and plenty of drugs and drinking. At the end of 1924, Harry persuaded Polly to formally change her first name.
To Polly?
No. They briefly considered clitoris with a Y.
I'm because you know sorry.
That's classier.
What the fuck did you just say?
They briefly considered Clitoris. They were going to change her name to Clitoris.
Okay, I like she goes from this like Boston elite lady to kind of this like
she's like a bohemian
polyamorous relationship in like Paris. Hippie dippy. Yeah.
So they, like I said, for the third time, they briefly considered naming her Clitoris before deciding on Caress.
That's slightly better,
right? Harry suggested that her new name, quote, begin with a C to go with Crosby, and it must form a cross with mine, end quote. The two names intersected at right angles at the R, and it was called the Crosby Cross.
Okay.
They did later name their second whippet, so their second dog, Clitoris, and explained to Caress's young daughter, Pauline, that she was named after a Greek goddess, which is a lie.
This got like a million.
I told you, it gets weird.
Like, I couldn't be prepared. It was already so fucking weird. And now it's just like, by the way, our dog's name is Clitoris.
Yeah, right.
And we almost named my wife Clitoris, but her name's Caress. And
so here's just like weird little things that Harry did, because I just wanted to include this because I needed
you
to
have
know how weird this got.
I did
cut out large chunks of this, so like if you really want to read up on her, you're gonna have to do it yourself, because this was 17 pages long and I cut it down to 11. So
Jesus Christ.
So after this whole Clitoris Caress thing.
Debacle.
In 1925, Harry had sexual relations with a 14-year-old girl he nicknamed Nubile with a quote, baby face and large breasts.
No!
In Morocco, during one of their trips to North Africa, Harry and Polly took a 13-year-old dancing girl named Zora to bed with them.
No!
Harry also had sex with a boy of unspecified age, which was his only homosexual dalliance, just so you know.
No homo, bro?
Yeah, right? Like,
what the fuck?
Also, in 1927, in the midst of his affair with Constance, so he's still in the affair with Constance.
Okay.
Harry and Caress met Russian painter Polya Chetinov, and Harry asked her to paint Caress's portrait and soon fell in love with her. In November, Harry wrote to his mother that Polya was, quote, very beautiful and terribly serious about art. She ran away from home when she was 13 to paint, end quote. He was also in love with his cousin.
Is there anyone his dick isn't hard for?
No.
That is so creepy. Like, I'm not trying to be judgy, but, like, adolescent kid? Like, no.
In June of 1928, Harry met Josephine Roach at the Libdo in Venice while she was shopping for her wedding trousseau, and they began an affair. In her autobiography, Caress minimizes Harry's affair with Josephine, eliminating a number of references to her. However, Harry told Polly that both Constance and Josephine wanted to marry him, even though earlier he said Constance didn't want to marry him.
Is he so, just, you know, like saying, yeah, everyone wants me?
Yeah. So, as they were living this rich expatriate life, obviously they were attracted to the bohemian lifestyle.
Yeah. They're attracted to everything that moves.
They settled in an apartment close to the bank, and Harry had Polly don her red bathing suit and row him down the river to the bank. He would wear his dark business suit, formal hat, and carried an umbrella and briefcase, and Caress would have to row home alone in her swimsuit. And remember, she has a generously endowed chest.
Yeah.
So she drew a lot of whistles, jeers, and waves from workmen. She later wrote that she thought the exercise was good for her breasts and she enjoyed the attention.
All right, then.
Yep. So, now they start smoking opium.
They weren't already. Are you sure? No.
The first experience they had was in Africa when their friend Constance, God, you gotta love this woman.
She's just all over the place.
When their friend Constance knocked on their door late one evening and they jumped at her invitation to join them at Drosso's, who I think was Constance's husband at the time, apartment. Ready for bed, Caress quickly put on a dress with nothing underneath. Invitations to Drosso's were restricted to a few regulars and occasional friends. The DeRosa's apartment had been converted into an opium den, subdivided into small rooms filled with low couches and decorations. After that introduction, Harry dropped in at DeRosa's frequently and sometimes stayed away from home at days. So basically, he got addicted to opium.
Yeah, he's like getting stoned at his buddy's place.
Right. After about a year, Harry tired of being a banker and quit, fully joining the lost generation of expatriate Americans. So the lost generation is the generation after like World War One.
Okay. What a sad name for a generation.
They came of age during World War One, I guess is what it is. And they it's lost in the context of like disoriented, wandering, directionless, because they came of age during a time of like great confusion, and you know, that's why they're called the Lost Generation.
Oh man.
But apparently there was a bunch of them in the 1920s in Paris.
So. It kind of reminds me of like all the kids who went out to California in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Like they hitchhiked out there and were just like living the free love lifestyle.
So if you hadn't guessed it by this point, Harriet wanted as little to do with Polly's children as possible. After the first year of living in Paris, her sons were shipped off to school in New Hampshire and their daughter was sent to a different school.
Honestly, so they might have been better off for it.
100%. The couple cared little for their future and spent their money recklessly and never tried to live on a budget. This was in part because they had pledged a mutual suicide pact in which they planned on October 31st, 1942, when the Earth would be closest to the sun, to jump out of an airplane together. This was to be followed by cremation and dispersal by another airplane.
That's such a like high school goth emo thing to like, we're gonna jump out of an airplane on Halloween and we're gonna hit the ground like holding hands, and then our bodies are gonna be shoveled up from the pavement.
Apparently it was like a thing.
We're gonna be cremated
and then jumped out of a different airplane again.
That's gonna be the same airplane, man, because it's all about how nothing ever changes.
Right. So they were renting a fashionable apartment in Paris, but also obtained a 20-year lease on a mill outside of Paris, which belonged to their friend Armin de la Rochefoucauld. They leased it for $2,200 gold pieces, which is about $32,821 today.
Damn.
Oh, not bad.
That's more than she got for the bra.
Right. They named it Le Moulin de Soleil, which is the Mill of the Sun. All right. I'm going to skip this part because it doesn't really matter, because it's mainly about her husband. Basically, her husband inherited a bunch of like rare books and he sold half of them. And sometimes he would just like slip rare first editions into stalls, like so people could like buy them and the stall owners would make money.
Oh, my God. You know, I was just going to ask, like, where are they getting all this money? Because he quit his job.
Right, exactly. It's rich families. So at this point, Caress was taking on lovers of her own. I'm not going to name them. There was a bunch.
A fuck ton of lovers.
However, behind closed doors, Harry applied a double standard, quarreling violently with her about her affairs. Occasionally, they strayed together, though, and they would often meet other couples and drive out to the country where they would draw the cars into a circle and change partners.
So they
were doing wife
swingers,
swapping.
Yeah.
Caress and Harry published her first book. Yeah, now they're publishers. In late 1924, it was a volume of conventional, quote, unadventurous poetry centering on the ideas of love, beauty, and her husband.
Love, beauty, and her husband.
Right. In 1926, they published her second book called Graven Images through Houghton Milfin in Boston. That was the only time they used a publisher other than themselves.
Because probably no one is going to publish this shit except for them.
But basically it was one of Harry's cousins was like, oh, they just lost one of their female, you know, writers. I bet they'll pick up your wife kind of a thing.
Ah.
Crosby's poetry remained relatively conventional. Quote, still rhyming love with dove, which is how she described it.
Oh, my God.
While she got some good reviews, the New York Herald said, for all its enthusiasm, there is no impact to thought or phrase. The emotion is meager and the imagination bridled.
Yeah, it's like your high school poetry, right, where you think it's really great and everyone else is like, it's been done.
Yeah. In 1927, they decided to found their own publishing company called Editions Narcisse after their black whippet, Narcisse Noir. I do like that name for the dog, though.
It is. Epic.
I mean, it means black narcissist, but...
It was kind of, like, the narcissist seems so appropriate.
I know. Oh, yeah. It 100% does. So they used this press as an avenue to publish their own poetry, but, like... And they would publish it in small editions, and they would, like, make them super nice-looking, and they were all hardbound, so they were, like, fancy.
Fancy. People think they're getting something really cool, and then they open it up, and they're like, what the fuck?
Their first effort was Caress's book, Painted Shores, in which she wrote about their relationship, including their reconciliation after one of his affairs. Her writing started maturing during this time, and the book was more creatively organized than her prior efforts. In 1928, she wrote an epic poem, which was published as The Stranger. This writing was addressed to the men in her life, her father, husband, and son. In an experimental fashion, she explored the various kinds of love she had known. Later that year, Impossible Melodies explored similar themes. Both books enjoyed a positive reception, and they decided to expand their press to serve other authors as well. So, that, like I said, they printed limited quantities of meticulously produced, hand-manufactured books printed on high-quality paper. So people really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
In 1928, they changed the name of their press to the Black Sun Press, in keeping with Harry's newfound fascination with death and the sun. So he, you know, is still weird. The press rapidly gained notice from publishing beautifully bound, topographically flawless editions of unusual books. They took exquisite care with the books they published, choosing the finest papers and ink. They published a lot of early works of a number of avant-garde writers that people may have actually heard of before, such as James Joyce, Kay Boyles, Ernest Hemingway, Eugene Jolas, D.H. Lawrence, and Lawrence Stern, among
others.
Holy
shit! I love how Ernest Hemingway made his way into this story twice. But not through the same person, necessarily.
Right.
Because, no, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Harry was the ambulance guy.
It was Dick.
Dick knew him first?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The Black Sun Press evolved into one of the most important small presses in Paris in the 1920s.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. And she, Cress, would go on publishing until she left Europe for the United States later in her life. So, like, she was into it.
That was her thing.
Yep. So in 1929, Harry met Henri Carter Bressian at Les Bourgettes, where Henri, so it's Harry and Henri.
Which is French Henry.
Yeah, exactly. All right. That's why I'm not saying Henry, because I'll just get it confused again. Where Henri's air squadron commandant had placed him under house arrest for hunting without a license.
Oh my god.
Harry persuaded the officer to release Henri into his custody for a few days. The men found they shared an interest in photography, and they spent their time together taking and printing pictures at Harry's home. Harry later said that Henri looked like a fledgling, shy and frail and mild as whey.
And then they fucked.
No. Remember, he only had that one gay encounter.
Yeah, that's what he says.
A friend of Harry's from Texas encouraged Henri to take photography more seriously, and embracing the open sexuality offered by Harry and his wife, Caress and Henri fell into an intense sexual relationship.
Ooh.
Yes. Okay.
No.
So, in 1929, Josephine comes back and rekindles her relationship with Harry, because I guess it was pretty intense, even though Polly minimizes it in her book. It's pretty intense.
That's why she minimizes it. She's like, I can't write about this for more than 2 seconds.
So in 1929, Harry and Josephine met and traveled to Detroit together, where they checked into an expensive $12 hotel.
Oh my
god. Which is
god.
About $179 today, which is not an expensive hotel.
No, that's like, $150 is, like, pretty cheap even.
Right? Like, that's where I would go.
Yeah. Man, how fucked up is inflation where even when we put this money into modern terms, it's like, that's fucking nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So an expensive hotel at the Book Cadillac Hotel. As Mr. and Mrs. Harry Crane.
Crane?
Under an assumed name.
Why? Who the hell cares? You right? are fucking everyone and everyone knows it. Why even pretend?
Well, also, it's like at this point, they're living in Paris and they're in Detroit. No one's
going to
fucking know.
No one knows you.
Anyways.
Well, what if we come back?
Right. For 4 days, they took meals in their room, smoked opium, and had sex.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds like a pretty fun vacation.
Right? In November of 1929, the lovers returned to New York, where once again they attempted to end their affair, and Josephine agreed that she would return to Boston and her husband, and Harry would go his way, you know, back to his wife.
Yeah, they would part ways and go back to their semi-normal lives.
But 2 days later, she delivered a 36-line poem to Harry
Dick,
who was staying with Caress at the Savoy Plaza Hotel. So he's staying with his wife, and she sends him this 36-line poem. The last line of the poem read, "Death is our marriage." On December 9th, Harry wrote in his journal for the last time, quote, "One is not in love unless one desires to die with one's beloved. There is only one happiness. It is to love and to be loved," end quote. Harry was found at 10 p.m. that night in bed at Stanley Mortimer's studio in the Hotel des Artistes. He had a 25 caliber bullet hole in his right temple next to Josephine, who had a matching hole in her left temple.
Oh, God!
They were in an affectionate embrace. Both were dressed but had bare feet. Harry sported red-painted toenails and tattoos on the bottom of his feet. I don't know why that's important.
Probably because it was weird to them.
The coroner said that Josephine had died at least 2 hours before Harry. There was no suicide note, and newspapers ran sensational articles for days about the murder-suicide or double suicide pact. They couldn't decide which.
Yeah, like my you're guess, just chilling my guess with your dead lover. What happened
is she shot herself, and then he panicked, and then eventually shot himself.
He was like, "She shoot." Okay, so he's like, "Death is, you know, the only way you love someone or whatever." So she's like, "Yeah, I'm totally on board with that." Shoots herself, and he's like, "Well, maybe I don't love you that much." Right? Like he starts questioning his commitment.
He's like, "Well, I can't leave now."
What the fuck, like. They should have just run off together. Right, I understand. Dumb. This seems so unnecessary.
I know. I told you. Oh, my God. Weird. Harry left Caress $100,000, which about today is about $1,489,000.
See, that sounds like a lot.
So that's what he left her in his will, along with generous bequests to Josephine, who also died. So I don't know. But I suppose it was probably in case they didn't die together.
Yeah.
But he left generous amounts to Josephine, Constance, and other women. His parents, however, had his will declared invalid, but assured Caress that she would receive $2,000 a year salary until she received money from Walter Berry's estate, which was only $23,000. I don't know who Walter Berry is.
I'm not going to say I would, like, turn down $23,000 extra dollars a year, but compared to $1 million, I would be pissed.
Right?
Like,
oh, yeah.
Okay, so my husband kills himself with his lover,
and his parents invalidate his will, so I get nothing.
Yeah, it's like, I didn't do that. Like, shouldn't I get something? Right. My husband's, like, totally off his rocker. And I'm not trying to, like, diminish the fact that he completed suicide. But everything leading up to this shows me he does not know what's going on.
Exactly. So she returned to Europe, and she brought her daughter Pauline home. Her son Billy was also brought home. And Pauline stayed with her mother for a few months with the kids. Or that is the kid, because she refused to return to school. She wanted to stay with her mom. While Billy did return to school, and then in 1931 went back to the U.S. to attend Lenox School. Polly retained Mary as her birth name and was known after her husband's death as Mary Caress Crosby.
So she kept Caress.
Just as a middle name, yeah.
Okay.
The Black Sun Press broadened its scope after Harry's death, although it published few works after 1952. It did print James Joyce's collected poems in 1963. So at this time, Caress dedicated herself to the Black Sun Press. She also decided to do a side venture to publish paperback books, even though they weren't yet popular yet, which she named the side venture Crosby Continental Editions. Ernest Hemingway offered her a choice of The Torrents of Spring or The Sun Also Rises as a debut volume for her new venture. Unfortunately, Caress picked The Sun Also Rises, which at the time was less received.
It was the less popular one.
I mean, now everyone knows about The Sun Also Rises.
Right.
But at the time, yeah.
I get it, though, because her whole, like, publishing company is The Black Sun. So why wouldn't you pick the book that says this? That's right. What I would have picked.
After 6 months of sales, the books that she had published, because she did publish she published 9 other books, but she had only grossed about $1,200, and she was unable to persuade publishers to distribute her work as paperbacks were not widely distributed yet, and the publishers
I know, the story is long as hell, man.
Publishers were not convinced the readers would buy them, so she closed that side venture in 1933.
That's too bad. It's like she was just too far ahead of her time.
In 1934, she began a love affair with a black actor / boxer named Canada Lee, despite the threat of miscegenation laws. They would lunch in uptown Harlem at a black restaurant where they could maintain their secret relationship. Unlike so many of her lovers, Lee didn't ask her for any money, even when he was having troubles of his own. However, Polly's brother expressed dismay at their relationship during a dinner. Caress was offended and then stopped talking to her brother for like 10 years.
Was it like a racist thing?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Cut your racist family out of your life. You do not need them.
So eventually that fizzled out. And then when Polly was taking Pauline to Hollywood, she met Selbert Burt Saffold Young, who was an unemployed aspiring actor and former football player, 18 years younger than her. However, when he saw her standing in a restaurant, he immediately came over and asked her to dance. She described him as handsome as Hermes and as militant as Mars.
Ooh. I love the way she describes her lovers.
Right. Without a job, he convinced Caress he wanted to own a farm, and they decided to look for land on the East Coast.
God.
Right? They drove into Virginia looking for an old plantation house smothered in roses. Which is weird. When the car broke down, she accidentally discovered Hampton Manor, a Hereford cattle farm with a dilapidated brick mansion on 486 acres in Bowling Green, Virginia. On September 30th, she wrote the New York Trust Company and instructed them to send 433 shares of stock to buy that property. Polly and Bert were married in Virginia, and he always asked her for money. He crashed her car, ran up the telephone bill, and used all her credit at the local liquor store.
I'm not even surprised. Nothing surprises me about this
anymore. He ended one bout of drinking with a solo trip to Florida and did not come back for a year.
Oh my God.
This is probably my favorite section. So in 1933, Caress met Henry Miller. He returned to the U.S. and there, you know, he met back up with Caress and described his lack of success in getting his work published. His autobiographical book, Tropic of Cancer, was banned in the U.S. as pornographical, and he could get no other work published. She invited him to take a room in her apartment, and he accepted, though she did not provide him with any money.
Good girl.
Desperate for cash, however, Miller was churning out
pornography.
was churning out porn on commission for an Oklahoma oil baron at $1 per page. But after two 100-page stories that brought him $200, he could do no more. Now he wanted to tour the United States by car and write about it. He got a $750 advance and persuaded the oil man's agent to advance him another $200. He was preparing to leave on the trip, but still had not provided the work promised. He thought then of Caress. She was already pitching in ideas and pieces of writing to Anis Nin's New York City Smut Club for fun, not money.
Oh my God.
Caress was facile and clever, wrote easily and quickly with little effort. Caress accepted Henry's proposal. She wrote at the top of the title given to her by Henry Miller, Opus Pastorum, later republished as Henry's work as Under the Roofs of Paris, and started right in. Henry left on his car tour, and Caress churned out 200 pages, and the collector's agent asked for more. Caress's smut was exactly what the oil man wanted.
Oh my God.
According to his New York agent, no literary aspirations, just plain sex. In her Caress, the agent had found the basic pornographic Henry Miller.
So
they thought Henry Miller was still writing for them.
Right.
It was really Caress.
That is fucking wild. How much fun would it have been to write porn back in the day? I feel like it would have been so easy.
Right.
Like, what we consider basic vanilla would have blown their fucking minds.
Right, I know. Although Bert was often drunk and infrequently home, Caress did not lack for company. She extended an invitation to Salvador Dali and his wife, who were long-term guests.
Wow.
During which he wrote most of his autobiography. She even hosted a masquerade party in their honor. She also was visited by, obviously, Henry Miller, Ezra Pound, and a bunch of other friends that she had made in Paris. They'd come and visit her. And in 1941, she divorced Bert and moved to Washington, D.C., and opened the Caress Crosby Modern Art Gallery, which is the city's first modern art gallery.
Damn.
Yeah.
The woman who invented the bra has had more sexual adventures than I can even imagine, and then became an accomplished porn writer.
Right.
Opened the city's first modern art gallery.
Right.
Because fuck you.
She did some activism that didn't go well in Greece. She tried to open a center, but Greece was no. And they, arrested her and wouldn't let her in the country.
Was she too much for Greece, of all places?
I think it was they were still, kind of in the war mind frame.
Okay.
And so they were kind of no, you know, you're dangerous in our country, so you're not allowed in. I didn't write too much on it because, like I said, it was really long, and I was we're skipping this section.
Yeah.
In winter of 1954, Caress's son, Billy, who was in charge of the Paris office of the American Overseas Airline, died. In his sleep of carbon monoxide poisoning, because he and his wife, Josette, had a small third-floor walk-up apartment that they heated with a fireplace and a stove.
Oh, shit.
So he died in his sleep. However, his wife was found unconscious but was able to be revived.
Oh, well, poor Billy.
Right? Here's the thing that brings it all back around to us.
You mean we're not just going to talk about sex and porn the rest of the time?
No, because this is the end. Suffering from heart disease, she received what was then still experimental open heart surgery at Mayo Clinic.
Oh my God! Mayo Clinic! Yeah,
Brings it all home.
That's where we live. I was just there last weekend.
Right. However, she did die from complications from pneumonia in Rome in 1970 at the age of 78.
Oh my God.
New York Times described her as the, quote, literary godmother to the lost generation of expatriate writers in Paris. Her friend, Anise Nin, described her as, I like this one, quote, a pollen carrier who mixed, stirred, brewed, and concocted friendships, end quote.
I think that's an appropriate assessment. She kind of knew everyone and was friends with everyone and fucked everyone and, like, what an insane life.
Oh, yeah. She lived, and what was nice for her is she lived long enough to see many of the aspiring writers that she had nurtured become well-known and accepted authors. Like, by the time she died, Ernest Hemingway was a big name.
Yeah.
You know, what was the other one I said? James Joyce was a big name, you know. The bra she invented went through a number of transformations and became a standard undergarment for women all over the world.
Including these two bitches here.
Right. Her first two husbands and her son preceded her in death. However, she was survived by her daughter and two granddaughters.
Aw. I hope Pauline had, like, a chill, happy life.
I don't know. She married some... Her daughter's name at the time of her death was Pauline Peabody de Munnorth Drysdale. So I'm going to say, yeah, she married well. She was buried in some really long cemetery name in France that I'm not even going to try and pronounce.
France. You scoundrels with your language.
Legacy. Most of her papers and manuscripts are held in the archives of Southern Illinois University.
Oh.
Yep. In 2004, Fine Line Features optioned a screenplay called Harry and Caress. And they had a director and a producer, but since it's now 2020 and I haven't heard of it, I'm guessing it never went through. But a screenplay was written about Harry and her life.
I was going to say, because her whole story seems like one of those, like, British dramas you'd see on PBS or even, like, a Netflix original. Like, there's sex, there's intrigue,
right? There's literally, like, people. Everything.
Like,
yeah.
It's so much, though. I feel like people would watch it and be like, there's no way any of this is real. And then everyone behind the show would be like, that's the crazy thing. We didn't blow this up at all. This is just what happened.
Right.
These people were all over.
I know, that's
the place.
Why I was, like, reading it. I was like, dear God, like, this literally sounds like it was made up.
Yeah.
But it wasn't.
That is, God, she lived such a crazy life.
She had a dog named Clitoris.
Like, for better or for worse, what an insane life. I'm just mad because throughout all this, like, I know she had the publishing company and her husband worked, but I'm like, how did she do all of this? Like, I have a decent job. I can barely live. I had to buy tires and I cried because I got
the
cheapest
so
tires
expensive.
And they're still expensive as fuck.
It's okay. We have a podcast.
Yes. Speaking of which, Patreon people, help me eat.
Buy us wine.
That should be that. I feel like that should be our slogan. Whining about herstory. Help us eat.
But no, like you hear, I hear because I watch like Twitch and YouTube and stuff a lot. And a lot of those creators instead of like, some of them have Patreons, but some of them have just like a button that literally says buy me a coffee.
Aww.
And so it's like $1 and you buy them a coffee. We should have buy me wine.
Yes, please.
That's what it is. Contribute $1 on Patreon.
We all
buy
know
us wine.
We all know that it's so much more than that. Even coffee.
Right, I know.
Like that's at least $4.
I mean,
bucks.
if you buy like a giant thing of Folgers, depending, you can maybe make it $1.
Oh
my $1
God.
Per cup.
So I used to buy the super cheap ground coffee, and sometimes like there would be chunks of the coffee. It looked like a fucking wood chip,
yeah,
and I'm like,
gross.
This is what I'm putting in my body because I'm poor.
All right, now that I've talked for like an hour,
oh
it's
my
your
God.
Turn.
Like that was such a cool story, but yeah, it never.
Oh yeah,
ended.
No, and like I said, I cut. chunks out because I was like,
you cut 6 pages of
yeah,
shit.
I was, well, and even like as I was reading, I still cut chunks out because I was like, eh, because I had like more about her thing in Greece, but I was like, eh, it didn't go anywhere. We're skipping that.
Yeah. Oh my fucking God. Well, thank you for sharing. My story is only 2 pages.
Yeah. No, I went with like, oh, cool. The person that like got the first patent for a bra. And then I'm like, what the fuck happened in your life?
You know what's interesting? So there's a drunk history episode where they cover her, but they basically just talk about her inventing the bra.
Yeah.
And they're like, and then she did some publishing and blah blah blah, but they like,
no, shit
there
got
is
cray.
No inkling that she was like this
opium
smoking, everyone
open relationship,
fucking publishing,
yeah,
got like literary, got, oh my God. But yeah,
right. And this is the thing, she wrote a lot of stuff, like,
yeah,
not just the porn. Like, she wrote a lot of stuff that people were like, no, this is good shit.
But you know what's really appropriate is in that drunk history episode, she's played by Courtney Cox,
oh, yeah,
who also has a crazy fucking name.
It's appropriate.
All right. So I am covering Saida Al-Hura, the Islamic pirate queen.
Hence why we're drinking out of a bottle that reminds us of pirates.
And I mean, Cyprus, Greece came into there, that
yeah,
whole region.
I think
so.
They had pirates.
Oh, hell yeah. Anywhere there's water, there's pirates.
Herstory Headcanon. Great Lakes pirates.
Were there, though? Like, seriously, why weren't there?
Right, there probably was.
There probably were. Okay, so before I begin, I want to assure you that I had this woman picked out before I heard your story on Grace O'Malley. This was just our natural femistry in alignment.
Did you just say femistry?
Damn right I did.
I like that.
It's amazing.
I just wanted to make sure I heard you right before I was like, that's an awesome word.
There's like a whole list of alternative names for things that are like feminine related. So like herstory, we all know. Femistry. I don't know the others. Those are the
it's
only two
there.
I can think of. The truth is out there, you guys. Yes. Anyway, so we don't know much about Saida's early life. We do know that Saida was not her real name. Her real name was, buckle up, Lala Aisha bint Ali ibn Rashid al-Almani.
That was beautiful.
I tried really hard, you guys. So Saida al-Hura was her title, which means noble lady who is free and independent.
Nice.
Yes.
I want that title.
Right? So we do know that she was from the Kingdom of Granada in Spain. She was born around 1485, which was towards the end of the Reconquista, which was a centuries-long struggle between the Christian kingdoms and the Muslim Moors across the Iberian Peninsula, which consists of modern-day Portugal and Spain. So this was kind of like part of the Crusades,
yep,
but the Spain-specific, like,
yeah,
is the Reconquista. So Granada, where Saida grew up, was one of the last Muslim-controlled kingdoms. In 1492, she fled with her prominent noble family to Tetuan, Morocco, as Granada was overtaken by Christian forces led by Ferdinand II and his queen, Isabella I.
I know those names.
American listeners will recognize Isabella and Ferdinand from stories of that Dick Cheese Columbus, but they were also the driving force that took over Spain and caused Saida's family to flee.
Dick,
so like 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, all of that like plays into this. So Tetuan became heavily populated with refugees fleeing the fighting and persecution.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Naturally. Being part of a noble family offered security and privilege, including a grade A education. During her studies, Saida became fluent in multiple languages and was taught by notable Moroccan scholar Abdullah Al-Ghazwani.
Nice.
Again, I just assume he's a big deal.
But see, so a lot of these women we talk about learn multiple languages, and sometimes I find that more impressive than other achievements because I'm like, your brain doesn't do, like, after you're a child, your brain doesn't do, there's something in your wine, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I think it's part of the wine has, like.
Oh, it's just bubbles.
No, there's something
bubbles
in there because it was sticking out of the glass. So this wine is very sweet.
I can't.
It's like.
Do more than those, like, 3 sips I had.
Yeah, but there's, like, a molasses.
Oh, yeah.
Essence to it. And I think it's just, like, congealing on the side of the glass.
Oh, what I was going to say is your brain stops, like, being able to learn languages well after you're, like, 7. That's why, like, the earlier you can learn language, the better it is. So, like, these women that are, like, in their teens or later, and they're like, I'm gonna go learn all these fucking languages. I'm like, you are so impressive.
Right? Well, and just especially living in America, a lot of kids take Spanish growing up, but it's not like we're really learning it. We're getting by with the class or whatever we're supposed to do.
I took Spanish for 3 years and I know barely any of the language.
Oh, yeah. No, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, it's sad.
But this, there was more need for it back then, too, especially, like, living in Europe and Spain.
Yeah, like, exactly. Those and especially, areas. Like, being a refugee, like, you're going to need that.
Yeah. So, despite her elite upbringing, her family's forced exile from their home hung heavy over Saida. Because, yeah, it sucks to have to flee your home because of war, no matter how good your life turns out.
Right.
So, at 16 years old... At 16 years old, Saida got married to a man named Ali Al-Mandri, who was around 46 years old.
It's only 30-year difference.
Only
it's
30
fine.
Years. It's fine. It's fine. It was likely a good political move, if not gross, as her husband was a family friend, fellow refugee, and the city's governor.
Oh, yeah.
He's kind
great
of a big
political
deal.
Move, then.
It's said that the marriage was arranged when Saida was a child, so this was like a planned thing. The city of Tetuan, where they lived, had been devastated early in the 15th century, and Ali had spent a lot of time helping with the rebuild and fortification. Saida joined him in these efforts, because, like, hey, we're living here, we might as well make it not suck. Being married to the governor came with its perks. Saida was exposed to his political and business affairs and was soaking up that sweet, sweet knowledge. We're
it's like,
snorting
it's like
up
opium.
That sweet, sweet knowledge. We're bringing it all back. Ali even made Saida de facto governor when he was out of town.
All right, that's cool.
So she's like running shit.
Well, and I'm glad that, you know, he trusts his wife enough to be like, yeah, sure, you can be in charge.
The age gap is gross to me. I get it was a different time. I acknowledge that modern sensibilities, but he comes out pretty good in this story. Like, he seems like a capable individual.
Because, like, normally I'm guessing a lot of men at that time would be like, no, I'm not going to leave a woman in charge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
So, good on him.
I actually get into that a little bit. So when her husband died in 1515, because he was already ancient, it was a natural move for Saida to become the new governor, earning her title Ahura, which is like noble queen or lady boss. This made her the last person in Islamic history to officially hold this title.
Wow.
Hashtag lady boss. Have you seen that video?
No.
Oh, I think I posted to her Facebook ages ago, but okay. Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend does a thing about, like, how it's hard being a boss and a woman, because it's like, I don't want to be a bitch, but I want to get shit done.
Oh, no, I did see that, yeah.
Hashtag lady boss. Yeah. Everyone go watch it after this episode. Now, you'd think that people would take issue with a female ruler because, you know, most of history. But the people of Tetuan had gotten used to Saida being in a position of power and ruling when her husband was away, so they were pretty cool with it. It also wasn't unheard of for women to inherit power in that region, a la Queen Isabella, going back to her, who had just, like, finished her rule in 1504. Like, she died, I think. Something. As ruler, Saida and her fleet controlled the western Mediterranean Sea around Morocco. A lot of Muslims had turned to piracy to fight against the invading Christians, and Saida recognized the effectiveness of sea battle. Not only that, she excelled at it.
Fuck yeah.
She teamed up with renowned pirate Baba al-Rush, also known as Barbarossa, who controlled the eastern...
Are you sure it's not Barbossa?
No, it's Barbarossa.
I know, I just had to ask.
Barbarossa. Bar. Oh my God, don't sue me. So together, like, so they teamed up.
That's stuck in my head.
Forever. It's stuck in everyone's head, and you're just gonna bop along. So when I was a kid, I didn't think the song was Barbara Ann. I thought it was Bobber M, because that's the way my dad would sing it. Like, M short for Emily. So when I figured out it was Barbara Ann, I was like, who the fuck is Barbara, you bitch? That's my song.
I don't know what I used to think it was.
Yeah, I thought it was Bobber M.
I thought it was Bob or something.
Yeah. No, it's Barbara Ann. Fuck her. Barbara Ann. Fuck her. She's a fucking bitch. Empowered women, empowered women. Anyway, together they seriously fucked up Spanish and Portuguese ships and terrorized their routes. She stole their loot and captured their sailors to ransom back to them.
Yes.
This was a financially fruitful venture, yeah, but also a great FU to the Christians who had forced her family to become refugees when she was a child. Because this time, it's personal. Dun dun dun, explosion in the background, don't look back because it's cooler.
She's sailing away from
Yeah, she's sailing away from the explosion.
Just
like
standing on the bow, just like, fuck this shit.
Yes. Okay, so
I need someone to draw me a picture of that.
Can we get some fan art, please?
Right? Please.
Veronica, are you an artist?
Is your son an artist?
So one of her more fruitful enterprises was a pirate raid on Gibraltar, where the amount of riches...
I know the name.
I know, yes. Finally, something sounds familiar. So the amount of riches they plundered filled all of their ships.
Fuck yeah.
For her effectiveness and ruthlessness, Saida became the undisputed pirate queen.
Well, in that area.
No. Ever. Grace was not born yet, I don't think. Or she was a baby.
That's still not ever. It's just for this time period.
Ever, Kelly. Here, my pirate queen's gonna fight your okay. pirate queen, and we'll see what happens.
That's another fan art we need.
Okay, so because she was such a pain in their asses, most of what we know about Saida comes from Spanish and Portuguese records, because they wrote about her all the time. Like, dear diary, Saida really hurt my feelings today because she
also
took my
stole
ship.
My ship.
Yes. Saida worked closely with their...
Threw me in the ocean.
I got all wet and I'm sad. So Saida worked closely with their rulers to negotiate prisoner exchanges and discussed other diplomatic issues. So she's not just like cutting and running. She's such a force that they have to confront her and like work with her.
Right. She makes them.
They feared her, but they also respected her power.
Fuck yeah. Hashtag Lady Moss.
Yeah. In 1541, the Sultan of Morocco, Ahmed al-Watasi, took notice of Saida and her power and asked for her hand in marriage. Saida agreed, but...
I thought she was going to be like, no, fuck you.
Wait for it. But she was busy being a badass ruler and didn't have time to travel all the way to the capital for the wedding. So she made the Sultan of Morocco...
come to her.
Travel to Tetuan to marry her. And this was a big power move. She's dual wielding those titties,
right?
And swinging them around.
She's like, if you want me, you have to come to me.
Come get me, bitch. The Sultan agreed, and for the first and only time in Moroccan history, the Sultan married outside of the capital.
That's huge.
Holy fuck. Even though Saida was now queen of the whole fucking country, she continued to act as the governor of Tetuan. Saida continued to rule, pirate, and kick ass. She was instrumental in efforts to unify Morocco against Spain and Portugal, which were quickly growing in power. However, because there's always one of these... After ruling for 30 years in total, she was deposed by her son-in-law in 1542.
God damn it.
Yeah. This was only about a year after she got married. So I think this is a lesson for all of us unmarried gals. Just don't get married.
I don't know. I haven't been... What was the word?
Deposed.
Well, for a second I was like, did she say disposed of?
No, she was deposed. So she wasn't like murdered.
So she wasn't her husband, basically it was probably her husband that actually got.
It was her son-in-law.
No, but I'm saying he probably took over as Sultan, not
yeah.
mayor of whatever.
Tetuan. Yes.
I was
yes.
gonna say it wrong.
Tetuan.
But you know what I mean? So really he disposed of her husband, and so that therefore, she lost her position as well.
See, I don't know. I don't know, like, if he was already dead or what the deal was.
Okay.
But basically, her son-in-law came and fucked shit up for her. So, Saida
that
fled
dick.
To Chefchaouen. Chefchaouen, yes. We don't know much about her time after being usurped, but she died 20 years later in 1561. So I like to think she took all of her pirate swag and just chilled like a boss.
She probably just like built a mansion, was like, I'm going to live here
now. She's like got a place on the beach. She just goes and chills and like counts her gold and like reminisces about all of the people she captured
right.
and like how she
it's good
was
times.
A big pain in the ass for Spain and Portugal.
Good times.
So super quick. I don't know if we had this conversation on air, but remember when I was trying to think of like a women's history pun for legacy?
Yeah.
Well, The Simpsons had the answer.
Oh, Jesus.
Legacy.
I both like hate that and love that.
So there was an episode where it was like a woman who wrote a book about like being more than a wife or like being a boss, and it was all like, you know, exaggerating, like whipping your man into shape or not even having one and all that stuff. And so it was full of those like lady puns and legacy. I was like, why didn't we think of that? It's right fucking there. So anyway, legacy. Saeed Al-Hurra is recognized as one of the most notorious female pirates in history, and she was a central figure in the modern age of Western Islam. I also love her story because it's one of the few where her womanliness isn't explicitly used against her or a hindrance. She was just a badass babe who ruled the land and sea. The end. We're ending on a less sexy and turbulent note.
Yeah.
But yeah, she, I mean, like, I'm sure there was it was a little unusual for her to have so much power.
But apparently not that unusual.
There's also not like a ton of information on her. And again, a lot of what we know is written by the people she was pissing off.
Which is great.
But yeah, there was never that
moment.
I want
my legacy to be written by the people I stomp on along the way to greatness.
I stomp on the way to greatness. Can I get that on a shirt?
My history will be written by the people I stomp on my way to greatness.
That is, oh my God.
I will put that on a shirt.
That is the fan art. I think we found our merch. Oh my God. Well, that was one hell of an episode. Kelly, what are you thankful for this week?
I'm thankful for this recording session. I've kind of had like a weird... We talked about it, like, not like a shitty week, like some days were bad, but like it's just been a very meh week. And we talked about this on like Wednesday. My mental health has kind of not been in a very great place. I've kind of been in a funk for a while, but I was really looking forward to today, our recording session, and, you know, and like all day I was like, yes, Emily's coming over tonight. We're going to record.
Aw, so I love you.
I'm thankful for this.
I've kind
for
of been
you, love.
I've been kind of the same way this week. It's like these
it's
extreme
the fucking Minnesota
ups and downs.
Snow bullshit blues.
Not only that.
It snowed
that,
a lot this week.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know why I bother shoveling because 2 seconds later, everything's covered in snow.
Right.
But I've kind of had that like extreme ups and downs, and I've just been like trying to weaponize my frustration.
Right.
So like Wednesday, Kelly and I had been going to Zumba and you couldn't go because the mental health thing was not there.
And it was snowing.
I don't
like driving the snow.
I'm glad you didn't though, because I went with a bum tire and it wasn't super, super bad going there. But coming back, I was like, Kelly would fucking hate this. But it was one of those things where I was like, I was having a really rough time. The week was only half over and it was snowing and I was like, fuck everything. And I went to Zumba and actually I had a really great experience.
And I think if my mental health had been fine, I probably would have driven. But I'm like, my mental health's already super shitty and I know I'm going to like have high anxiety if I go out and drive in the snow. And I don't think that's going to be a good idea.
I love how you're accentuating your frustration with like banging the
table. Justin hates when I do that. I'll like tap on things with my nails to like emphasize my point and he'll sit there and do it back because it annoys him.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, what? I have nails. I tap them to emphasize my point. And he's like, it's annoying. I'm like, I don't care.
I speak with my whole body.
I do.
So I'm thankful for two things. One, so Jared's grandfather is in the late stages of Parkinson's.
That's rough.
He had a fall and ended up in the hospital. And they realized I don't know if it was his blood pressure or his heartbeats per minute. Basically, super fucking low. And they're like, well, that's weird. So he got a pacemaker. And so Jared and I went
That's huge.
Yeah. Like, and they go in through your groin and just kind of shoot it up into your heart.
Yeah.
They don't have to open you up. It's crazy.
Weird.
So we went to visit him in the hospital and Jared was super anxious about it, especially since the last time he was there, his grandmother was dying and that was not
a good time.
There's
a lot of people that don't want to go to hospitals because, every time they've gone, it's...
Someone's dying
or
someone's like miserable. Yeah. But his grandfather was doing so well. Like, he was great. Chatty. He was making jokes.
He's doing good.
Yeah. And he walked around.
I'm sure he's feeling better. Like, because if you have, like, a low pulse or low blood pressure, like, that fucks up everything.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he was probably feeling better than he's felt in a while.
Well, and the thing is, it's like, he's in the late stages of Parkinson's. So a lot of his, like, low energy or even, like, you know, there's probably some depression going on there. Yeah. It's all attributed to, because Parkinson's is
sucks.
Awful.
Yeah.
But to figure out that there's something else going on then treat it was great. And so I hope that this is like, this helps him.
Yeah.
I know it doesn't remove the Parkinson's, but
any slight improvement in quality of life is worth it.
Yeah. But so that was really nice. And so Jared and his mom were there and they were all like joking around and having a good time. So
good.
I'm thankful. And then also, like I said, I went to Zumba. And remember the first time we went and there was that lady we were chatting with and I was like, she looks super familiar. I think she's the mom of some of the kids I worked with. She totally is. We were chatting during Zumba and I mentioned, I used to work at this daycare, and her face just lit up and I'm like, is this your last name? Are these your kids' names? Because I wasn't just going to say, so are these your kids' names? I know you don't know me, but I know everything about you. And so
way to not be creepy.
Yeah. Well, she recognized me.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm saying it's good. Like, you did it in a non-creepy way instead of just walking up and being like, I know your children.
Oh my God. Top 10 ways to just get your ass beat. But they were a really great family to work with. And so it was great catching up with her. And she was like, you were such a good teacher. We were so sad when you left. I was like, if they paid me a living wage, I would still be there.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah. But it was really nice. And so I'll see her at Zumba again. And yeah.
Not next week.
Nope. I told her that.
You have shit.
I told her that I wouldn't be there because I would be naked in front of a bunch of people. I will be channeling my inner Polly and just... getting naked in front of strangers.
This is our lives.
This is our lives.
On that note,
thank you so much for listening to Whining About Herstory. Please follow us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHpod,
Twitter at WAH_pod. Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com and our email address is whiningaboutherstory@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you.
If you want to give your mom a shout out, like Michael did for Veronica, because he's a good son, email us.
Or Twitter message.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Just reach out to us. Also,
we're lonely.
Check out Earfloss, Music History Podcast. He's amazing. All their episodes are amazing. They have an episode on Lizzo, you guys. Oh my God, I love it. But listen to Billie Holiday first. You have to.
You have to go listen to us.
You
first.
Are legally obligated. Also, we have a Patreon. If you want to throw a little cash at our way to make up for the gender wage gap.
Yeah, come on. 75 cents on the dollar. It's bullshit.
We would appreciate it.
We love you.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And have an empowered day.
Bye.
Family lamb.